Before we dive into today's discussion, we've got a special resource just for you, a free ebook called Does It Make Sense to Believe in God? In today's world, where faith is often labelled as outdated or irrational, this ebook takes a fresh look at the evidence for God. It features reflections from years of engaging with some of the world's leading atheists, like Richard Dawkins, and reveals why, after hearing every conceivable argument, our confidence in God's existence is stronger than ever. Download Does It Make Sense to Believe in God today for free at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, let's get on with today's show.
From now until the end of December, tune in to Premier Christmas Radio and experience the hope, peace, love and joy that only the sounds of Christmas can bring. Enjoy hours of Christmas music, classic carols and festive favourites. Listen now on the Premier Plus app or your smart speaker. Premier Christmas Radio, the real sound of Christmas, in association with Open Doors.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi there.
Hi, Tim.
So today we're going to be talking about a whole slew of kind of recent stories and developments coming out of the world of embryology and molecular biology, really. Before you switch off, we'll keep it nice and straightforward for the lay non-scientists like myself to understand.
What, you mean you're not fascinated by embryology?
Fascinated, yes. Confused, very much so. But hopefully we're going to try and cut through some of the jargon and make it make sense. I guess, and the reason we want to talk about this is because it doesn't get much of attention in the kind of mass media, the mainstream news world. People are understandably preoccupied by things like the pandemic or, you know, the looming energy crisis, the war in Ukraine, big political stuff like that. But what we want to try and shed a light on is that all of this kind of turmoil hasn't stopped a large number of scientists in labs around the world kind of quietly pushing the envelope and pushing what is possible in this really kind of fast changing world of embryology and biology.
Yeah, I think it's interesting how just quietly working away in labs, you know, this immensely powerful and successful science is continuing, and with a lot of international collaboration, teams in many different countries, in the States, in Europe, the UK being one of the world leaders in this field, but also China and Israel is another important player. So advances are just steadily going on and leading to the most remarkable possibilities as we look to the future. So we thought it would be good to just review some of the recent news items and then perhaps step back a bit and just talk a bit about, you know, where is all this science going? How is it being regulated? Where might it go in the future?
Yeah. We'll try and, as I said, we'll try and make it as comprehensible as possible. But let's start with a story which was from 2021, so a year ago. Published in the kind of very respected journal Nature. The headline is Lab-Grown Structures Mimic Human Embryos Earliest Stage Yet. And as far as I understand, you're going to tell me where I've misunderstood this, but as far as I understand, it's basically scientists have used human stem cells to kind of create an embryo-like growth or structure for the first time.
That's right. So the human embryo starts as a single cell. Fertilization normally takes place actually in the fallopian tube where the sperm and the egg meet, and then very rapidly over the first few days the cells multiply and you end up with a little ball of tissue with a strange name, the blastocyst, which then is wafted down the fallopian tube and then eventually implants into the wall of the womb. And what happens is that it's possible to reproduce this within a test tube. But as we'll come back to, so far, 14 days, the limit at which you've been allowed to grow embryos in a laboratory has been 14 days. This recent advance is instead of creating a human embryo from a sperm and an egg and then allowing them to grow, scientists have been trying to synthesize artificially an embryo using a collection of stem cells from different sources and getting them, putting them together in a little ball. And what they've shown is they've been able to create an artificial blastocyst, which is actually very similar to the genuine article developing from a sperm and an egg.
So this is obviously quite a kind of significant scientific advance in that, you know, throughout all of human history, the only way to start life was to have a sperm from a man somewhere and an egg from a woman somewhere and to combine them. And whereas this is now, you're saying human stem cells. Should we just quickly explain what are stem cells? How are they different to a sperm and an egg?
Yeah, so the astonishing thing about human biology is you start with a single cell, the fertilized egg, which is simply one cell with a nucleus and cytoplasm and a layer around the outside. And yet from that single cell, you end up with all the types of cells that you get in the human body. And it turns out there are about 200 completely different types of cell within the human body, you know, ranging from brain cells, skin cells, gut lining cells, bone cells, hair, you name it. And all of those completely different kinds of cells are come from a single cell, the one cell embryo, and they are then continually reproduced. So we continue to make sources of brain cells, and we continue to make sources of skin cells, of blood cells, and so on. And these are called stem cells, which are just continuing to reproduce throughout the whole of our lives. As cells die, we're continually making new cells. So by taking some of these human stem cells, which have been previously obtained from different routes, and putting them back together, the idea is to try and recreate a synthetic embryo.
I guess it's worth noting that this blastocyst, this kind of very early stage embryo, is never going to be able to grow into an actual person. It's more of a kind of facsimile, a copy of an actual human blastocyst, which has grown naturally from fertilization.
Well, that's true at this stage. In other words, it's a pretty close copy, but it's got some clear differences, abnormalities from a genuine blastocyst. And that's why people think that if you were to put it into somebody's womb, that it would miscarry, that it would not continue to develop into a normal human baby. As far as the scientists go, this is actually an advantage because it means that it isn't covered by the laws and the regulations which cover normal human embryos. And so that means effectively that they would be able to carry on doing what they want to do in the lab without worrying about the laws. And in particular, one of the major aims here is to try and create tissue which can be used for medical purposes.
Which that kind of leads us on to another one of the stories you wanted to pick up on, which was coming out of a startup called Renewal Bio, which is a biotech company in Israel, which says that it is planning to, or hoping to create kind of clone embryo versions of people in order to harvest tissues to then use in transplant treatments.
Yeah, so again, taking this idea, the idea is that I could create this embryo-like structure in a lab which was based on my own DNA. And as someone put it, it's a kind of mini-me, to use that idea, a tiny little replica of myself. This is growing in a lab somewhere as a collection of cells, but then it could be allowed to grow and grow. And then I could use this as a source of tissue for being transplanted back into me. And the great advantage is that because it would be genetically identical to me, there wouldn't be any problem about rejection. So, for instance, if I was developing kidney failure, in the lab, this little thing growing that you could remove the developing kidney cells in this structure in the lab and grow them up into a kind of or kidney-like structure and then transplant into me in order to cure my kidney disease.
And we should explain for people who aren't aware, you know, at present when you have a transplant of someone else's kidney, one, you have to work quite hard to get a very particular person's kidney so it's not rejected, and even then often transplant patients have to take drugs for the rest of their life to prevent their own immune systems from attacking the kidney as a kind of foreign substance, which has a whole bunch of nasty side effects. So this would be quite a radical kind of shift if possible.
Yes, at one level, it would be a very major advance in medicine to be able to have virtually an unlimited supply of different kinds of tissue. So whatever it was that you needed, skin transplant, you know, because you had a terrible burn, or maybe you've got some dementia and you've got need new brain cells or memory, improve your memory. Maybe you've got cardiac problems. You need to. So you have this sort of endless supply of new tissue, which is going to be matched to you. And so immediately here, there is a fantastic commercial potential. I mean, across the world, the billions of dollars that are spent on medical treatments, particularly like transplants and so on, so that if a company, a private company, was able to make this kind of sophisticated biotechnology work, you know, you could be charging tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars for compatible tissue. And so there's a huge amount of venture capital money going into many of these companies, and many of the scientists have bought shares in their own startups in the hope that they might end up not only being very famous scientists but also making a great deal of money.
Some of the quotes from the lead scientist, who's called Jacob Hanna, in this Israeli firm are quite astonishing to me. I mean, to read, he said this in the story about how they would use these tiny human kind of cloned human embryos to grow organs. Quote, "We view the embryo as the best 3D bioprinter. It's the best entity to make organs and proper tissue. The vision of the company is, could we use these organized embryo entities to have early organs to get cells? We view it as perhaps a universal starting point." So he's really kind of saying this is very much creating an embryo of kind of ambiguous morality and humanity simply as a factory to generate organs for another person.
That's right. And this, I mean, in that article, he says he's already talking about keeping these structures going for way beyond the 14-day limit, to 40 days or beyond. And at the moment, there would be no kind of law governing these things because they wouldn't be covered. In the UK, there's the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Act, but that really only applies to genuine human embryos and not to these kind of entities which are being synthetic embryos created in a lab.
Well, we're going to dig in a bit more about the regulatory kind of framework and where the 14-day limit came from and that a bit later on. But before we do, one more story I wanted to quickly pick up on and share with listeners is about gene editing in embryos. So rather than creating a kind of artificial embryo from stem cells or anything like that, this is about actual kind of quote natural human embryos, using revolutionary technology called CRISPR, CRISPR, all capitals. There's a scientist in China who is kind of infamously a few years ago announced that he had started using CRISPR to edit the DNA, the genome of a set of twins, and then kind of grew them to term, and they are alive in the world somewhere in China. Do you want to explain a bit more about the significance of that?
Yeah, so CRISPR is an astonishingly powerful technology, relatively recently developed, which allows a scientist in the lab to design a probe. I understand it's almost as simple as just typing into, you know, on a laptop and working out what you want to do and pressing the button, and you can almost design these things whatever you like. And what that probe then does is it take out of the entire human genome the billions of base pairs, or so-called, you know, the letters, the billions of letters out of which the human genome is composed. It can select a single letter and then, in theory, change that letter. And so the idea would be that if you have a baby who has a genetic abnormality, which might lead to something like a sickle cell disease, you could intervene at the one cell embryo stage, or very small, very early stage. You identify that one gene which is abnormal. You use CRISPR to fix it back to a normal state. You put the embryo back. You let it grow, and then put it back in the womb. And effectively, you've cured the child of sickle cell disease. They will grow up as a normal, healthy baby. That's the vision, and at least in theory, the technology might allow that to happen. This one Chinese scientist claimed that he'd done this, immediately there was a kind of international scandal, and the Chinese authorities rapidly clamped down on him, and he was put in prison, and the whole research group was disbanded. But it does show that this kind of idea of gene editing is an idea whose time has arrived.
I guess we should quickly explain why that was so scandalous, even in the kind of world of kind of cutting edge embryology. And as far as I understand, it's because what he was editing is what's known as the germline. And so he was introducing mutations and kind of conscious changes to the genes in these children, and they will carry that in their DNA forever. And if they have children, we'll pass it on. And it then spreads out eventually in enough time throughout the whole kind of human race. And so you're really kind of playing with fire here, because if you introduce harmful errors or mutations while you're editing the genome, it's not something that can just be, you know, disposed of in a lab. It will filter down, you know, for time immemorial.
That's right. So the normal kind of gene therapy and gene editing, which is carried out already quite commonly, is called somatic cell gene editing. And what you're changing then, cells might be in the blood or, you know, in the bone marrow, might be in the elsewhere, tissues in the lung or whatever. But when the patient eventually dies, that mutation will die with them. It won't be passed on to the next generation. But when you change a cell in an embryo, when you change the DNA in an embryo, that DNA will be copied into every cell of the body, including the gametes, the sperm or the egg. And that means they would then be passed on to their children and to their children and to their children. So far, the international community has regarded germline therapy as a kind of line in the sand that we shouldn't go down, although it's been regularly discussed, and there are many scientists saying that, you know, ultimately this is irrational. You know, the kind of argument goes, just to go to the side, if we use smallpox virus in order to eradicate smallpox from the world, it's a kind of public health intervention, is that fundamentally different from using germline editing to eradicate sickle cell disease from the world? You know, it doesn't stop us from doing these other major public health interventions. Is that fundamentally different from germline editing?
I guess one of the reasons for concern is another story you sent me from Nature from a few years ago, where the headline, the chilling headline, is this: CRISPR editing wreaks chromosomal mayhem in human embryos. Studies showing large DNA deletions and reshuffling heighten concerns about heritable genome editing. So what I'm taking from this is that the tool CRISPR, which we have been using to edit genes and various things, and now people are playing around in humans, is actually not as precise or not as accurate as we thought. And this is reporting on a study that's been done, which showed that the tool made kind of off-target gene mutations, where, you know, the scientists hoped to dive into the genome and change one particular letter among all the code, but discovered actually in doing so they'd unintentionally changed other letters, which is clearly, and if that, you know, if these kind of random, uncontrolled mutations get introduced into the germline, you know, you can see that would have enormous ramifications.
Exactly. So, again, tragically, these kind of things are well recognised. There have been cases in the past where genetic modifications have been made that have been tragically led to cancer in the people in whom these modifications have been made. So it is known that you can have unanticipated side effects from targeting genes. And the great worry, as you say, is that if this is done in a germline treatment, then you might have whole groups of children and their offspring, all of whom turned out to have some genetic abnormality which really affected their lives.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Okay, so that's a kind of very kind of whistle-stop tour of some of the new developments and kind of cutting-edge breakthroughs in science happening in the world of embryology and stem cells. Shall we kind of zoom out a little bit and talk about some of the regulatory framework and kind of the philosophy behind a lot of this research before we can then talk about what we feel about that as Christians?
Yeah, and I think if we can just do a little bit of history, and in particular it's history about the UK, because historically the UK has been always one of the leading players. The UK scientists have been leading players in this kind of field. If you can remember, it was in the UK, in England, that the first IVF baby was born, Louise Brown. And so in the early 1980s, there was a lot of growing concern about the possibility of doing things with human embryos and what was going on, and the fact there was no kind of regulation of what scientists were doing in labs was causing a lot of concern. And so the British government set up a committee of inquiry called the Warnock Commission, and because it was chaired by an Oxford philosopher, Dame Warnock, and that became known as the Warnock Committee. And it turned out to be extraordinarily influential, not just in the UK, but around the world.
Hmm. And this, I guess, it was trying to figure out how do we draw regulatory frameworks around this kind of developing science of embryology. How do they go about that? What was their kind of, how do they come up with ideas on what was okay and what was not okay?
Yeah, so the question was, what was it appropriate to do with human embryos? Was it appropriate to grow them in the lab at all? Was it appropriate to grow them in order to do research on them and then destroy them? And how could the whole process be regulated? And one of the basic questions was, how long could you allow an embryo to grow in the lab? And of course, you know, if you think back, Aldous Huxley, Brave New World, other science fiction stories had sort of had been around for some time, postulating that you would be growing these human embryos into babies in test tubes, and those kind of science fiction horrors were already there in the public imagination. Mm. So the Warnock Committee basically just said, you know, anybody who would like to make a submission to the committee, please do so. And apparently there was over 200 submissions from all kinds, some from individuals, some from bodies, quite a lot from churches and Christian organisations. And not surprisingly, it rapidly became apparent that nobody can agree on these fundamental issues. And in particular, nobody can agree on the moral status, the meaning, the significance of a human embryo growing in a test tube in a lab.
And so if we don't know what we think the embryo is, how on earth do we go about as a society drawing up consistent universal rules on what research we can do on it?
Yeah, and this is where, you know, modern Western societies, which are fundamentally pluralistic, where you have a whole series of people with different beliefs, and often mutually contradictory beliefs about the world, the universe, and everything, ranging from a whole group of scientists who basically can't see what all the fuss is about. This is a collection of cells. They're the same as any other cells, and they're growing in a test tube. And why on earth are people getting so excited and so concerned about what we're doing growing in a cell, growing these cells and embryos, through to people from many different religious traditions who felt deeply appalled and felt that it was some kind of sacrilege that these highly abnormal human embryos were being developed. So, you know, it is a fundamental problem for modern societies, which I think historically, I mean, you're the historian, you tell me, my understanding is that until the 20th century, it was pretty well every nation had a primary dominant philosophical religious tradition.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't swear to that. Over time in history, there's obviously been, you know, going back thousands of years to the time of Jesus, you know, incredibly pluralistic and mixed societies ethnically and culturally. But I would imagine that, you know, certainly prior to the kind of Enlightenment, that the idea that we needed to pay great heed to the kind of soup of minority opinions was not massively commonplace, and it was, you know, it was a might makes right world, and the people group which had the kind of greatest power or greatest numbers, I imagine, for most of history, have been able to impose their own particular version of morality and ethics on everyone else. Whereas, as you say, in a multicultural liberal democracy, post-Christian society such as we have here in the UK, most people seem to agree that it wouldn't be right just to say, right, we're going to do whatever the Christians say, or we're going to do whatever the atheists say. There's a sense in which we need to try and find some kind of common ground or some kind of way of accommodating this wide array of legitimate but sometimes oppositional belief systems.
Yeah, and so what took place in the Warnock Committee is something that I think is really very significant and a very important shift. And that is, and Mary Warnock herself, as a philosopher, talked about this quite openly. And she said, you know, in retrospect, it became very clear very early on, we were never going to be able to agree as a committee on the moral status of the embryo. And yet, we needed to come up with something. We needed to come up with a regulatory framework. If there weren't rules, then the public were going to get concerned, and it might even lead to sort of social unrest, and laboratories would be ransacked by vigilantes and all that kind of stuff. So we've got to have rules that everyone feels happy with. And what she said was, so the question is not what is right or wrong, but what is socially acceptable? What kind of, as she put it, in what kind of society can we live with our conscience clear? And therefore, what happened was, the question is not what's right or wrong, it's what's acceptable. Time and again, we found ourselves distinguishing not between what would be right or wrong, but between what would be acceptable or unacceptable. So it's a kind of shift away from philosophy and theology towards sociology.
It's basically saying, we can't agree, and therefore we're not even going to try to come up with a vision, what we would call a theology, of what the embryo is. So instead, we're going to create admittedly arbitrary rules so that people don't think it's a free-for-all, but that there's no explicit moral justification for these rules. And is that true of where they came up with these 14-day limit? It's just, we had to draw a line somewhere, so we picked 14 days.
That's
otherwise,
right.
It would be the Wild West.
I mean, there was some vague justification for 14 days because the very earliest development of the central nervous system, you know, which initially starts to, you start to see the very earliest development of that in the embryo happens after 14 days. And so the 14 days was taken as a sort of absolute limit. We can be confident that up to this point, there is nothing about the embryo which could be remotely considered as to be like a central nervous system. And therefore, we're going to put a line in the sand and say you can keep an embryo in the lab and grow it up to 14 days, but it mustn't be allowed to grow beyond 14 days. Therefore, you must destroy it before it reaches the 14-day limit.
Which strikes me, just as a side note, as quite a curious compromise, because you're clearly saying, you know, they didn't land on either side of the kind of spectrum. You know, there's one half who say the embryo from the point of conception is a human being with the same rights and dignity as anyone else, and therefore any kind of experimentation on it is barbaric and must be prohibited. And then the other side, the kind of scientific side, a lot of the scientists would say, clearly this is just an interesting bunch of cells that we'd love to do some research on, and like we should be able to go as far as we want, or it's certainly to the point, you know, where it could become viable when reimplanted or something like that. And they didn't land there. They just said somewhere in the middle, that they said the embryo is not precious and unique and akin to you or I. You can research on it, but you can't do it forever. So you have to destroy it after 14 days, even though, you know, the act of destruction is, to people who take the kind of sacred point of view, is just as upsetting as the act of creation. I don't know. I just find the whole thing, it has a kind of surface level logic to it, but when you unpick it philosophically and theologically, it just seems to be slightly incoherent.
Well, and I think at one level you're absolutely right, but it was defended as a pragmatic solution, as a you know, effectively as a fudge, which then allows the scientists to get on and do their work. And of course, let's not forget, you know, these scientists are not primarily wanting to play God for the sake of it. I mean, there is a huge amount of pressure coming from people who, with infertility, and for those, you know, potentially with other genetic abnormalities, and potentially the science could be transformative, as indeed we know it has been. We know that IVF at one level has been very, very successful, and there are probably millions of children around the world who are born as a result of the kind of experiments that these scientists were doing. So there is a strong humanitarian pressure, and it's often presented as, why should some religious fundamentalist put an absolute roadblock and say absolutely no way, when we have this enormous possibility of doing good.
So we've had that 14-day limit basically since the 80s. And as that has stood the test of time, it's been written into law in many countries, including the UK, and in other countries, even where it's not written into law, it's kind of widely adopted by kind of regulatory authorities and researchers.
Yeah, so that was the interesting thing, really, that the 14-day limit was really created pretty well by Warnock. And yet, as other scientists and regulators around the world looked to the UK, they said, well, why not? Why don't we follow that 14-day limit? So pretty well around the world, in these international collaborations, scientists have agreed until very recently. And it's only just in the last year or two that 14-day limit is now being seriously questioned.
I guess in part that's because, as I understand, researchers actually weren't able to keep human embryos alive in a petri dish for more than 14 days, even if they wanted to, for most of the last 30 years. So it's been a slightly kind of, it's been a moot point. Whereas in the last 3 or 4 years, it's now become possible to that we've got better at keeping embryos alive in the lab, and therefore there have been projects which have had to kind of artificially terminate the experiments and destroy the embryos at 14 days to avoid breaching the standard.
That's right. And so just in last year, in 2021, the International Society for Stem Cell Research recommended that the 14-day rule should be relaxed, and that scientists could propose to grow human embryos beyond 14 days, and that each case would be considered on a case-by-case basis. There would be some kind of review, and there would be no ultimate limit. Each case would be taken on its merits, and you know, scientists and regulators would agree, in this case you can go to 21 days or 28 days or 35 days or whatever, that, you know, the 14-day limit is now effectively dead.
That hasn't yet been kind of written into law in this country, has it? Is there pressure from scientists to now amend the Act, the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Act in the UK to extend the 14-day limit here?
Well, there is, but as you know, not surprisingly, there have been other things going on, like COVID and war and everything else. And as a result, the attempt to change the law has rather been put on the back burner. But I think there's absolutely no doubt that within the foreseeable future, there will be a strong pressure being exerted in the UK and elsewhere around the world to change the law to allow embryos to grow beyond 14 days. And the reason for that is that some very important things start happening beyond 14 days, including the development of the central nervous system. So by growing embryos in the lab at this stage, we can learn much more about how the central nervous system and other body systems are being developed in this critical phase.
And so what do you think, we're kind of running out of time here, but and we'll talk about this more next week in the second part of this kind of episode series, but just briefly, what do you think is the kind of moral, theological, philosophical implications of this push to extend the 14-day limit? Why should we care as Christians, most of us probably not biomedical scientists, why should we care about this kind of esoteric debate within embryology regulation?
Well, I do see it as a very significant liberalisation of the law, because for all its many deficiencies, I think the way that the Warnock Committee recommended that the regulation should work has actually provided some kind of framework and particular limits on what scientists have been allowed to do. And I think once you take away that 14-day limit, I suspect it's going to be extremely difficult, if not impossible, to replace it with, say, a 28-day limit. I think that we are now entering a new phase where potentially it will become possible to grow human embryos almost indefinitely in the laboratory, as long as the scientists can come up with some kind of justification. So I do think this is a significant advance in liberalisation, and I think, you know, it's going to become really important for us as Christians to try to respond and think about this. And that's certainly something I'd like to discuss next week. How do we engage, particularly where there are things going on which we feel deeply concerned about, but which could have real benefit? You know, it raises this question of cooperation with evil, doesn't it? Which we've talked about before in the context of COVID vaccines.
Yeah, there's lots of really difficult challenges coming up. You know, put bluntly, you know, can we accept as Christians a future world in which, you know, all transplant organs are perfect and work perfectly, but they've been grown in kind of bizarrely cloned embryos and artificial wombs? You know, how do we work out the moral value of something which might have had its origins in research that we find distasteful or even immoral, but has clear kind of benefits?
As we approach the end of the year, I want to take a moment to reflect on the incredible work God has done through Premier Insight in 2024. This year, we've launched new podcasts like Rico Tice's and provided impactful books and resources, and we've shared the powerful N.T. Wright videos to help people grow in wisdom and share their faith with clarity and compassion. But this ministry wouldn't be possible without you. Your generosity has equipped countless believers to live out their faith. Right now, we face a $112,129 funding gap that must be closed by December the 31st to sustain this vital work. Your gift today will not only help us finish this year strong, but also lay the foundation for exciting plans we have for 2025. Visit premierinsight.org to give today. Together, let's make an eternal impact for God's kingdom. Thank you for your generosity. And now, let's get back to today's episode.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
I think, you know, this is a classic example, isn't it, where traditional biblical historic theology and understanding really finds itself struggling to conceive of these new entities that are being created in laboratories. There's both the question of a normally constructed human embryo, which is, you know, in original creation order, is intended to be inside a woman's body, inside the womb, in this safe place, as in Psalm 139, in the depths of the earth, seen and known by God, but instead is in a laboratory, in this sterile environment, multiplying, observed, processed, analysed. And then you've got these very weird simulacra, the things that are almost human but not quite, constructed out of stem cells, again growing indefinitely, and creating tissue and organs. So these, you know, this sounds like science fiction, this sounds like Aldous Huxley, Brave New World, but it's real science. And how do we get our heads around this from the perspective of the historic biblical Christian faith?
Mm. And it's the kind of situation where, you know, you'll go to scripture to look for guidance and teaching on human-like stem cell-derived blastocysts, and I'm afraid you'll come up empty, because this is just simply, you know, the worldview of the biblical authors just cannot even comprehend what is going on in labs around the world now. And so you have to do, I think, as a Christian thinker, we have to do quite a lot of work to think about how do we attach our kind of gospel first principles and work them forwards to the world that we live in, because you're not getting a lot of help from kind of either the scripture itself or from the kind of church tradition, church fathers and previous writings.
That's right. And of course, there have been church theologians have been grappling with these issues right from the very earliest times of the church, in the sense of trying to understand the significance of the developing human in the womb. And there are really two traditions which you can trace. One tradition, which saw, however far back you go, there is a person, there is a human being at a very early stage of development. And the other view, that there was some point in human development at which, this was sometimes called ensoulment, or some other point at which in human development the soul entered, or the person could be identified. And that before that point, the being in the womb, although significant, didn't have the significance of a full personhood.
Hmm. It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think a lot of Christians, particularly evangelical Christians, instinctively come down on or feel like the Orthodox view is the first one, that, you know, we've been kind of raised in a world, let's face it, probably driven mostly by the kind of abortion debate, that humans exist from the point of conception, from when the sperm first meets the egg, and that drives, I think, a lot of Christians' instincts, which is to find all embryo research, whether it's one day or 14 days or 28 days, to be wrong, because they see that as a human being equivalent in dignity to you or I.
Yes, I think you're right that if you were to take views from most Christian denominations in 2022 on this particular issue, I think that the majority view would be that the human being deserves protection and concern from the point of fertilization, from conception. And I think, you know, it's interesting that to some extent there's been quite a shift in my lifetime. When I was a student in the 1970s, there was quite a strong view amongst evangelicals of the kind of developmental view that human personhood didn't start from the very earliest stages. And there were certainly there were people who taught that, but there were people who held the alternative view, including highly respected people. So, but it, and certainly in private, those views are still expressed. I mean, many people that I know would express those views in private, but they've, for whatever reason, I think the dominant view that is taught in the pulpits is the view which previously was very much the Catholic view that said life was important from conception only.
Well, can I put you on the spot then, just quickly, and say, do you think there is merit, or are there arguments in favour that you think are worthy of consideration which contradict that, which say that at some point between conception and birth, the embryo becomes a person, and before then is not the same? Are there things that we should consider? Those of us who might have just taken for granted the kind of conception argument, are there things that we've overlooked?
Well, I think there is this extremely troubling but absolutely watertight evidence that a huge number of embryos that are created fail to implant and are lost in, and that the mother doesn't even ever know that the embryo was there. But it is, that is very well scientifically documented, and I've certainly had, I've been challenged by that by a number of people who say, how can you possibly believe, therefore, that every embryo is, are you suggesting that heaven is populated by vast numbers of tiny embryos who are people who died within a few days of conception? And I think also I've been challenged, you know, as somebody who has tried to defend the orthodox position. For instance, I mean, a classic way it's put to me is, okay, you know, there's a fire in the hospital, and in the fertility lab there's a test tube with 100 embryos, or you've got babies in the neonatal unit, you've got 5 babies in the neonatal unit, you know, are you going to save 100 embryos in the fertility lab and let the babies burn? And if not, why are you valuing, if you're telling me that embryos are people, why are you valuing your babies more than the embryos in the lab? So I think that, you know, once you start to drill down and push about this, it isn't, there are reasons to question, and the theological argument is that there is an argument that you do need a central nervous system, that personhood depends on some kind of individuality and awareness, and that the very earliest stages of the embryo, particularly before implantation, cannot be regarded as being an individual person, in the sense that would be the case later on in development.
Okay, so there's clearly, you know, disagreements within the church, within Christianity about this, but I think everyone would accept, wherever they stood on that particular question, that the embryo in very early stages of life is of huge significance. It's not just a bundle of cells like any other, and that we should try and construct a form of, you know, regulation around this research which accepts that there is kind of a morality to it. But that's actually not commonplace, is it, among, I don't know, the scientists or even the regulators themselves?
Well, certainly I know that many scientists who work in this field feel that the regulation is far too onerous and restrictive. You know, they look down their microscope and they say, you know, what's the big excitement about this particular bundle of cells? You know, if you look at a fruit fly embryo and you look at a chicken embryo and you look at a monkey embryo and you look at a human embryo, they all look virtually identical. Why are we all getting so excited about this particular bundle of cells? And particularly when these so-called religious, and they would say maybe superstitious or irrational attitudes towards this bundle of cells is impeding the onward rush of science and actually having deleterious effects.
I suppose we need to kind of flag up the fact that there is actually a fundamental philosophical cleavage here between the kind of Warnock approach, the pragmatic regulatory approach, and the Christian approach. You know, Warnock was explicitly saying, we're not thinking about right or wrong. We're not trying to come to a conclusion on the moral status of the embryo. We're simply about it putting, we're trying to draw limits and rules which can gain wide public support. And they don't need to have any more moral justification beyond that. Whereas it is intrinsic to Christianity that actually there is an objective right or wrong, and that we do need to try and discern the moral status of different acts and things. Otherwise, how can we know what how we're supposed to act?
Well, that's right. And I mean, I was very struck that Mary Warnock argued that the language of right and wrong was inflammatory. It was antisocial. It sounded arrogant. It provoked conflict. And, you know, she was writing that back in the 1980s, but that's that view that once we get into the public square, it's not helpful in some areas to talk about right and wrong. It's very interesting, isn't it? Of course, because if you go into some other areas, like, for instance, Putin's invasion of Russia, you know, we shouldn't use the language of right and wrong about Putin. I mean, that would be very inflammatory and would provoke conflict. Instead, we should just talk about what would be acceptable and what's unacceptable. Well, I don't think, you know, in that sense, that's not the case at all, is it? People expatiate about the evil, and this is utterly wrong. And so they have no doubt in certain acceptable areas to talk about right and wrong. But when you then go to these other contested areas about the abortion, about the embryo, then all of a sudden it's best not to use these categories.
Mm. Yeah, and I suppose it exposes the slight kind of shallowness of that idea of moral relativity, which is that no one is truly a moral relativist. You know, no one says, well, you know, the Holocaust, draw your own conclusions, follow your own cultural beliefs, you know, who's to say? We all really in our heart of hearts do believe in a right or wrong. It's just in some areas we think the only way to mediate between conflicting beliefs is to abandon finding objective truth. You know, what do you make of that? You know, in a world, we're not, you know, even more so than the world of the 80s, Britain today is a big melting pot of different religious beliefs, and increasingly people with no religious beliefs, but still a set of kind of ethics and values. I don't think you'd say we just impose our Christian theology on everyone else. Is there a different, a better way than the Warnock approach to try and come up with common shared rules on things like scientific research?
Well, I do think we do have the right as Christians to use these categories of right and wrong. I mean, I don't think we should feel just because other people don't like us using these words that therefore we're somehow gagged and silenced in the public square. And I and many others would argue that there is a place to talk about this is right and this is wrong. In the public square, but we have to recognise that that kind of language is often in this kind of area not very helpful. So, for instance, you know, you say, well, it's true for you, but it's not true for me, and how do I know, you know, what do you mean it's right? And this kind of language frequently fails, and therefore we need to find other means of language. And I think other arguments that can be used, and one is about outcomes, to argue that it is important that we live together in harmony, that we can trust one another. It's really important, therefore, that we can trust scientists, and that's why we do need to know that there are strong regulatory frameworks, and we as Christians therefore support strong regulatory frameworks, because that means that we can work towards the common good, towards social harmony, and towards trusting scientists rather than mistrust.
And I think a key thing I would like to see is far more kind of popular consent, consultation, even democratic oversight. Because reading, you know, what Warnock and her committee were saying, like hiding behind it and not hiding in plain sight, really is a kind of patronizing elitism, which says, you know, of course, us educated academics, whether philosophers or embryologists, we all know that, you know, this is just a bundle of cells and we can crack on. But of course, we need to make sure that the kind of uneducated masses who have superstitious concerns are placated. So we will come up with this openly arbitrary limit of 14 days, and we will draw thick black lines around what you can and cannot do, but all while knowing that this is really just, again, kind of popular consent, and is not, we're not going to try and pretend there's any kind of philosophy or morality behind this. And I just think that, I find that distasteful.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's actually a very, very English approach, I can see. This kind of English elitism, which is entirely sort of non-transparent, normally. It all happens behind closed doors, where the elite get together. So the elite politicians, the elite scientists, the elite industrialists and economists, and the regulators, and they all get together and they decide what's the best way to make sure that the masses are happy and there isn't kind of unrest and they don't get outed in the newspapers. And then they together agree to look after one another's interests, really. So the politicians, you know, when it comes to reproductive technology and the embryos and stem cells, you know, there's a lot of common interests here. The politicians want to make the UK the world centre for stem cell research, for these new therapies, for embryonic work and so on. If you have a very tight regulation in the UK, but it's very lax elsewhere in the world, well, then we're never going to be able to promote the science. So it's in the interest of the politicians to have a relatively liberal regime. It's in the interest of the scientists because they're hoping to win Nobel Prizes. It's the interest of the venture capitalists because there are massive profits to be made. And so we all get together in behind closed doors and we work out how can we get a regime which will allow us to get on, do follow our own interests, but which won't cause a lot of public unrest and concern.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Drawing kind of these thoughts together, shall we spend just a few minutes at the end of this episode thinking about, you know, what we should we do as Christians in the future world? Let's imagine that the limits are liberalized and relaxed, and that this kind of onward rush of progress, in inverted commas, in embryo research continues. Some of these stem cell therapies and genetic editing kind of progresses, and we come down to a world where this is kind of every day rather than kind of bleeding edge and sci-fi. How can we as Christians live in that world well? You know, do we need to, for example, if we're being offered to grow our own kidney for a kidney transplant rather than roll the dice on trying to find someone else's kidney, do we just say no, even though it might resign us to a painful death?
Well, just before getting into that sort of science fiction future, I do think one take-home message, I think, for this so-called democratic deficit is that we cannot expect for us as Christians to be taken seriously in this area of public debate about regulation of embryonic technology and so on, unless we are well informed and able to articulate our views in a way which is informed, relevant, and I think there's therefore a real need for at least some Christians to really inform themselves, educate themselves in this rapidly developing technology, precisely so they can contribute to the democratic debate. And I think very often, I'm afraid, Christians haven't been good in doing that. They've tended to collapse into very simplistic understandings. And as a result, often the Christian voice is ignored or marginalised in the debate. So I think there is a real... Sorry, somebody peeping their horn outside the window. I think there's a real need for Christians perhaps to up their game, at least for some people, to say, look, it's really important for us to become informed in this area and to contribute to the democratic debate. But then
perhaps
as we
by
go...
listening to a podcast, just a random idea.
Yeah, I'm sorry if this sounds like special pleading. But hey, but I do think the other thing is it is interesting to think that we may well find ourselves in a world in the future where we are faced with some very painful choices. You know, do I accept some life-changing, life-transforming therapy which has been developed in some very unpleasant and distasteful and possibly unethical ways?
Mm.
And I think there probably is a kind of some kind of analogy with a debate that went on about COVID vaccines when they were first being introduced.
Yes, that's what immediately came to my mind as well. It is, as some people might remember, that many, if not most, I think, of the various COVID vaccines on offer had, in their kind of research and development, had used what's called an immortal cell line. So these are human cells that have been kept reproducing indefinitely in a lab. And they can trace themselves all the way back originally to what is thought to be an aborted fetus in the Netherlands in the 1970s. And a lot of Christians, understandably, were quite concerned when they discovered this and had questions about, if I take the vaccine, am I in some sense complicit in the abortion of that fetus in 1970, whatever it was? And this is, I guess this comes down to what's often called the kind of cooperation with evil. Are you morally responsible for evil, which is not carried out by your hand, but if you benefit from it or in some way collaborate with the results of that evil, you know, isn't in God's eyes, is that the same thing?
That's right. And it is a deeply difficult and complex and contested area. But it's interesting that theologians and ethicists, particularly Catholic theologians, have been grappling with this problem of cooperation with evil for many centuries. And I think their analysis is quite helpful. And in particular, they divided between cooperation which was either active or passive, cooperation which was intentional or unintentional, and cooperation which was proximate, which was close to the evil act, or distant from the evil act. And so when applied to the COVID vaccine, you would say, you know, this was a passive involvement. Nobody intended that an aborted fetus should be used. It was something that was unintended and passive, and it was also a very long time ago it happened, you know. So it was, in that sense, the action of me having a vaccine in 2021 or whatever it was was very distant from this one event that might have happened with an aborted fetus back in 1970. But it's interesting. Let's apply the same reasoning. Let's suppose that some way of growing human embryos to a much later stage in the lab developed a new treatment for kidney disease, and I've got serious kidney disease, it might take my life. If I accept this treatment grown human embryos in the lab, it could save my life. So in this case, is the cooperation with evil active or passive? I think you could say it is active, because I am intentionally using an embryo which has been effectively grown for me in order to be. And therefore, is it intentional or unintentional? Well, I'm not intending to do evil, but on the other hand, I am agreeing with the creation of this embryo which is genetically identical with me. And therefore, it does seem as though the cooperation with evil is much closer to me, just speaking personally, compared with the COVID vaccine. And so I think you might argue that, you know, the act of saying I will refuse this thing which I feel morally deeply tainted, even if that's I'm jeopardizing my life, I will do that out of loyalty to Christ, even though other people may think I'm completely mad.
Yeah, I think it's a very challenging question, isn't it? And I think that the really helpful thing to think about, I think, is that idea of intentionality. And also, you know, there's a clear distinction between, you know, in some sense, deriving some kind of very, very disconnected benefit from the abortion of a child in the 1970s through to saying right here now in 2022, or more likely 2052, when this becomes possible, I'm going to commission the creation of a cloned embryo of myself and to treat it as a 3D bioprinter to create myself an organ. That you can't really wash your hands in the same way. You could say it was a tragedy that child was aborted, but I can't undo that now. These cell lines exist. The cells that the vaccine was tested on actually are, you know, millions of reproductions away from the actual cells of the fetus. That's a quite different for me, the idea of I'm going to actually ask a scientist to clone a tiny embryo, mini me, for me, grow it to 50, 60 days, and then discard it once I've extracted the kidney that I require.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think it is possible, as we come into this brave new world, that increasingly new therapies, new developments will come out of the rush of biotechnology, which Christians concerned about some of these ethical and moral issues may feel increasingly that they want to withdraw from. They don't want to. That there is, and the basic view behind this is that Christian theology views human life and the extension of human life as something, as an immense good, an immensely important good, but not as the greatest good. There are other things which are even more important, such as protecting innocent lives from abuse and from maltreatment, and therefore sometimes as Christians we're called to say no to some of the possibilities that technology is offering us because of a higher principle which we feel we owe loyalty to.
And then this kind of ties in with what you were saying about the need for Christians to up their game and kind of educate themselves, because I think there's that we might be entering into a world in the future where a lot of this will shift from kind of theory to practice. And what you don't want is to be first time you ever think about some of these ethical challenges is when you've just been given a kidney disease diagnosis and the doctor is there offering you the therapy. You know, we need to be ready for this, because these are going to be some of the decisions that, you know, we might be called to out of loyalty to Christ might be unbelievably costly decisions. They might really hurt in a physical and in an emotional sense. You know, they might lead to huge social ostracization. They might lead to our own kind of suffering or even our own deaths in kind of worst case scenarios. And in that moment of crisis is not the point to be first wondering, gosh, what do I think about embryology research and you know, stem cell derived blastocysts and all that kind of stuff. You know, the point to be doing that thinking is before the rubber hits the road, because it might just be that what God is calling us to do is a really hard thing to do.
Yeah, and of course none of us can be experts in everything that's going on there. You know, what we do need to do is to encourage people to develop their own areas of expertise and understanding, and then we help one another. We have within the Christian community people who are able to contribute and knowledgeably and help and advise others.
Is there a challenge therefore to get more Christians into, you know, stem cell molecular biology, or is that going to become more and more difficult because to work in that field will require you, by effect, to take part and directly cooperate in some of the evil things that might be happening?
Well, I think that's, you put your finger on a really important, interesting area, and perhaps it's something we can come back to and discuss in the future. But in essence, I think there is that tension. On the one hand, yes, in order to understand and really engage, it's very helpful to have Christians actually working in this field. But on the other hand, I think you can see that it may be that increasingly there are some areas of technology where Christians feel it becomes like a no-go area. We can still inform ourselves. We can make sure that we really understand what's going on, but that there are some areas where we feel we simply cannot be involved.
Well, lots to ponder there. Thanks for coming on this journey with us. I hope it hasn't been too esoteric. I hope we've kind of persuaded you that these are really interesting, if slightly complex, issues to discuss. And thanks for your guiding hand along the way. We're going to draw this series of episodes to a close. As always, there's lots of resources and articles to read and videos to watch and other podcasts to listen to on John's website. That's johnwyatt.com. You can get in touch with us by emailing molad@premier.org.uk. We're always really interested in particular in feedback on episodes, but also ideas of things to talk about in the future, new stories and developments you might have seen. So please do get in touch. And thanks to those who already have. And otherwise, thanks for listening. And we'll speak to you next week.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.